Hey, as you'll see, we're missing a few. Justice Hardesty had an obligation. Justice Herndon may be here in just a little bit. He was delayed coming in from Las Vegas. But everyone will be listening to the arguments and deliberating on the case. So I think we are ready to go. First matter is up, docket number 82161, Eddie Martell versus HG Staffing. Counsel, are you ready to proceed? All right. Did you want to reserve any time?
I would like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal, Your Honor. Okay. Chief Justice Perry-Gary, Associate Justices, my name is Joshua Buck. I'm here appearing on behalf of the appellant's plaintiffs in this case. This appeal presents numerous issues with respect to Nevada's wage and hour laws and how those laws are applied to the employees at issue in this particular case. Given the number of issues that potentially are presented in this appeal, I think it is appropriate to separate out my presentation into two parts. The first part deals with the district court's orders as they relate to appellant Jackson Williams' status as a union employee. And the second part will deal with the statute of limitations issues that are presented below. With respect to the first part and Ms. Jackson Williams' status as a union employee, I'd like to begin with the district court's most recent order, which is its clarification order, which stated that appellant Jackson Williams' 18-month period of time for her non-overtime wage claims were barred because she lacked standing to assert those claims. The district court asserted that she lacked standing because she failed to allege a breach of the fair duty of representation by the union. With all due respect, Your Honors, we contend that this was an error because Ms. Jackson Williams has never asserted any claims under the collective bargaining agreement. Her claims are brought pursuant to Nevada statutory authority, namely 608.016, which mandates that employees be paid for all the hours that they work, and also her claim under the Nevada minimum wage. Again, these are her non-overtime wage claims. Her overtime wage claims deal with a separate provision, and I will address that shortly. The district court's opinion and a clarification order is fundamentally irreconcilable with its other decision stating that appellant Jackson Williams need not exhaust the grievance procedure. These two positions, one, that she need not exhaust the grievance procedure in any purported collective bargaining agreement, and two, yet she does not have standing to assert any of her claims, cannot be reconciled because the alleged breach of fair dealing only comes out of a claim that a union member may have when they're trying to assert it under the contract. Again, the claims here are not being asserted under the contract. They're being asserted under Nevada statutory authority. Moreover, the alleged collective bargaining agreement that the defendants point to here do not contain any waiver or any requirement that employees proceed through the grievance and arbitration procedure in order to assert statutory wage claims. This is important because this is the requirement that the U.S. Supreme Court announced in 14 Penn Plaza. It's also a requirement that our sister Nevada Federal District Court recently recognized in a case called Woodman, where it states that union employees are only required to go through the grievance and arbitration provision under any alleged collective bargaining agreement if the alleged collective bargaining agreement clearly and conspicuously contains a requirement that statutory wage claims must be arbitrated. That is not present here. It's not present even under the alleged collective bargaining agreement.
Can I just, I just want to clarify when you're saying these points, is that just about Ms. Jackson Williams for her own personal claims, Or are you saying that also to the extent she seeks to speak for other similarly situated employees?
Both, Your Honor.
Okay.
First, individually, she has no requirement.
Right.
I think that's the law is very clear. Second, she can represent other employees, union or non-union, regardless, for statutory wage claims. Again, she's not suing under any alleged contract. She's suing under the statutory authority. As long as she meets the Rule 23 requirements, Your Honor. We have the Nevada Rules of Civil Procedure specifically set forth the requirements for her to bring a claim on behalf of others. Now, we're not there yet. We haven't had a motion for Rule 23 status. That's not before this court. What the court essentially said, although it said it a little bit inarticulately in my opinion, it said she cannot proceed with her claims because it granted summary judgment as to all of her claims, and she cannot represent other employees if she meets the Rule 23 requirements.
Yeah. But so to the extent the union is, as the union becomes the exclusive representative for the union members, how does that interplay with her effort to also represent other union members?
I would fall back on my prior argument. As long as it's not based upon the contract or contract negotiations or things like that, it has no relevance, frankly, Your Honor, because again, as long as this court agrees that the she is entitled to pursue her non-overtime statutory wage claims as well as potentially her minimum wage claim, as long as she meets the Rule 23 requirements, she can bring it on behalf of other folks. The second part of my first part, which is dealing with Ms. Jackson Williams' status as a union employee, concerns the district court's decision with respect to the overtime exception contained in 0183E. In 0183E, there is a collective bargaining exemption from the payment of overtime so long as there is a collective bargaining agreement and it provides otherwise for overtime. As you can see from our briefing, it's our contention, frankly, that the defendant in this case did not meet its burden to demonstrate that there was a valid and effective collective bargaining agreement. I focus on burden here intentionally because it is the employer's burden under the law to show that an employee is exempt from the overtime requirements under 018. And it is furthermore when an employer bears the burden of persuasion, then the employer must demonstrate with sufficient admissible evidence that it meets its burden. We submit that the district court erred because there was some doubt as to whether or not this collective bargaining agreement was really in effect. And I'll point to simply the history of the agreements that have been produced and are in the record. There are three agreements, or purported agreements. One from 2009 and 2010. That agreement is not disputed. It was in effect. It expired by its own terms in May of 2011 when the property was sold. Then we have another alleged collective bargaining agreement. As you can see from the record, Your Honors, this is an agreement without a date. It has a date from 2010 until 2020 blank. It does not have the party that is the defendant being listed. It is not signed. It is not dated. Then we have another collective bargaining agreement, which is the current collective bargaining agreement, which was in effect from 2016 until 2023. Notably, in that collective bargaining agreement, the very job position that Ms. Jackson Williams is no longer covered. In other words, she is no longer, her position does not fall under the collective bargaining agreement. So when we look at the history of the documents that we have in the record, we have a collective bargaining agreement that expired by its own terms in 2011. We have another agreement that defendant contends is a collective bargaining agreement that doesn't list defendant as a party, it's unsigned, it's undated, and it has red lines throughout the entire document. And then lastly, we have a collective bargaining agreement that is undisputedly in effect, but it does not cover the very position that Ms. Jackson-Williams worked under.
I just want to clarify. The agreement you're saying does not cover her position is that the last one that was signed.
The last one that was signed. And notably, Your Honor, I want to be clear here because I don't want to Ms. Jackson-Williams did not work under that agreement.
She had left.
But the point remains that as we sit here today, we know that she wouldn't have been covered in that last agreement. And just based upon the history of the CBA, we respectfully submit that the defendant didn't meet its burden to demonstrate that there was a collective bargaining agreement that provided otherwise for overtime. And that the district court, if it had any doubt as to whether or not the agreement was applicable, should not have granted summary judgment. It should have left it.
Wasn't there evidence that it was ratified, the union ratified that?
There was evidence set forth by the general counsel declaration that there were continued grievances that were being prosecuted, and also within one of those grievances, there was testimony of some kind of ratification. But, Your Honor, frankly, we don't know what agreement was ratified. And that precisely is the point. And even in that evidence that was attached to the general counsel's declaration, Ms. Hilden testified that the agreement that was in effect from 2011 till 2018. But we know that simply not to be true based upon the last agreement. The current agreement is from 2016 to 2023. There are simply just too many facts and too many disputes in the record to support the summary judgment being entered. Frankly, what would be more, I think, appropriate would be that this matter submitted for at least an evidentiary hearing on the particular collective bargaining
Counsel,
agreement.
Can you please address the statute of limitations?
Yes, Your Honor, and I apologize that my time has gotten away from me on that particular issue. The statute of limitations issue is important in this context. Obviously, this court has addressed the statute of limitations with respect to Perry under the Nevada Minimum Wage Amendment. In our briefing, I distinguish Perry, primarily because in Perry, this court had to construe what the limitations period was under a constitutional amendment where the Constitution does not contain any general de facto statute of limitations. Therefore, the court went and looked at the statutory provision under 260 to analyze and say, hey, there's a 2-year limitations period for a minimum wage under the Constitution. When we look at statutory violations, however, the Nevada legislature has specifically instructed us where to go when we do not see a specific limitations provision contained, and that is to Chapter 11. Therefore, when the district court stated that we should apply a 2-year limitations period to all wage claims, non-minimum wage claims, that was in error. I see that my rebuttal time has been encroached, and I would certainly like to address more of the statute of limitations issues and hopefully in my rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Diana Dickinson and I represent respondents HG Staffing LLC and MEI GSR LLC. Appellants' attempts to pursue a class action against respondents have now been rejected 3 times by 3 different courts. First by the Federal District Court, then by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and most recently by Chief Judge Lynn Simons of the Second Judicial District Court. Appellants continuously attempt to retool their arguments in an effort to avoid the inevitable conclusion that judgment should be entered in favor of respondents. At issue in this appeal are 3 orders from the district court, orders on a motion to dismiss the first amended complaint, a motion for summary judgment, and a motion for clarification. The district court's well-reasoned decisions should not be overturned, and this court should affirm. I would first like to address the statute of limitations argument that opposing counsel addressed. The problem with appellant's argument for a three-year statute of limitations claim for wage claims is they're trying to avoid the binding holding that this court issued in Perry v. Terribles. In Perry, this court outlined a procedure for identifying the limitation periods for wage and hour actions where the claim is not subject to an express statute of limitations. The Perry court never stated that its analysis was confined to the Nevada Constitution. Moreover, the Perry court looked at consistency within the statutory scheme when applying the NRS 608-260 limitations period and Nevada minimum wage law. What appellants are asking for would be completely inconsistent with the Nevada record-keeping laws that require employers to maintain an employee's wage records for 2 years. Appellants are essentially asking for the ability to bring a claim for overtime and final paycheck penalties after the claims for minimum wage have been time-barred.
Should we be a little concerned that the doctrine of analogous limitations was superseded by statute in the 2021 amendments to?
No, Your Honor. First, there is nothing in that statute that said it was retroactive. Right. These claims were brought in 2016. And moreover, that statute said that, quote, not herein before provided for, is what that statute said. And that does not address actions for relief that apply to a statute. So it wouldn't apply in this case. And moreover, it would just lead to completely inconsistent results, which is what appellants are asking this court to do, is to have different statute limitations for minimum wage and overtime would just be completely inconsistent and deviate from the purpose, one of the items noted in Perry, to promote uniformity when analyzing the wage laws. And that brings me to another item, the final paycheck period that was addressed in the briefs. The final paycheck statutes were enacted to promote the timely payment of final wages to employees whose employment had ended and to prevent employers from stiffing employees on the final paycheck. An example of this is the construction project where an employer completes the job but fails to pay its employees that final paycheck. In that situation, the usual motivation to pay employees so they continue working is gone as the work has been completed. It was in this type of situation that the Nevada legislator intended to prevent when it enacted the final paycheck statutes in 1919. Appellant's contention that these statutes apply to any failure to pay wages, even instances two years prior to the employee's separation, not only ignores the plain language of the statute and purpose of the statutes, but also produces an absurd result. NRS 608-040 is titled, quote, penalty for failure to pay, discharge, or quitting employee. And Section 1B states, if an employer fails to pay on the day wages or compensation is due to an employee who resigns or quits, the wages or compensation of the employee continues at the same rate from the day the employee resigned, quit, or was discharged until paid or for 30 days, whichever is less. Under the language of 040, the provision that wages or compensation continue at the same rate only applies if the employee has discharged or resigns or quits. In other words, only upon the final paycheck following separation. If NRS 608-040 applied to any other wages other than final wages, an employee would be entitled to a penalty of up to 30 days' wages, even if the employer had mistakenly failed to pay the employee pay a wage for a single hour 2 years prior to the employee separation. This turns into an automatic penalty against employers that is nonsensical and flatly contrary to the purpose of the statute. The only logical construction is that the statute applies to final wages and compensation, meaning those in the last pay period.
Ms. Dickinson, why can't Ms. Jackson-Williams assert her statutory claims on her own behalf?
Well, first, Your Honor, if she doesn't have any claims, which we argue, you wouldn't have to go to the standing argument. And that's what we brought up with the minimum wage and the trial and break-in periods that opposing counsel is trying to assert in such a way that's contrary to the purpose of the statute at 016.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch what you were saying there.
I was saying that Jackson Williams doesn't have any non-overtime claims. We're arguing because the minimum wage provision, there's an exception for a CBA, which we argue applies. And we're also arguing that the way that appellants are trying to apply 608.016 trial or break-in periods would only apply in specific instances, not to an entire time an employee is working for an employer. And in that instance,
if she was required to, if we assume for purposes of this discussion that she was coming in early and spending time and staying after her shift and spending time and was never compensated for that, why would she not have a claim under 016 for that?
016 was passed in 1985 as a curb against unpaid trials or break-in periods, which by their very nature involve agreed-upon wages to begin with. It was this insecurity of such an arrangement where employer does not guarantee employment for a gainful employment after a break-in period. And that was the history of why 016 was created. The employer may and often does release an employee at the end of a break-in period and the opening to the door to securing other employees to do the same thing. If you were to apply 016 in such a manner, you're essentially ignoring the plain language of the statute and also creating a claim for straight time or gap time claims that does not exist in Nevada statutory law. Ms. Jackson Williams can have a claim for overtime or minimum wage under the CBA. However, using 016 as a backdoor to overtime is inappropriate and not consistent with the language and judicial and legislative history of the statute.
So she's not entitled to be paid for all the time she worked?
She does have a claim. She has a claim for overtime and minimum wage, and she could also bring a breach of contract or quasi-contract. There are other ways to bring such a claim, but doing it through 016 deviates from the legislative purpose and creates more new causes of action that do not exist.
Sorry, what if it wasn't more than 8 hours in a day or more than 40 hours in a week, but she still was, but like if she was only paid for 35 hours this week, but there was five other hours she spent, for example, is there not a claim for that?
She could bring a breach of contract or a common law claim to try to get the whatever potentially the employer didn't pay her. But through using 016, that analysis flies in the face of the legislative history, as there's no indication that that it was meant to be a gap filler to pay in addition to minimum wage and overtime. Rather, the committee minutes made clear that the legislator was addressing the Labor Commissioner's request for additional definitions to clarify questions regarding alleged violations of NRS 608. The legislative history makes clear that that it was a codification of Attorney General opinion that employees should not be required to force employees to break in or on the job or for working certain indefinite periods without pay, and that's what that statute was meant to address. NRS 608.018 was enacted to prevent employers from using unpaid breaks and periods and releases of employees to get free services. And by reading it in addition to the statute, it leads to contrary results.
But what do you do with the first sentence of 016?
Well, first, I think it has to be read as a whole. It can't just be read one sentence, excluding the other sentences. The title of the statute is Payment for Each Hour Work, Trial or Break-in Period Not Accepted. And the first sentence, except otherwise provided in the two other statutes, and those statutes are for periods of sleep and domestic service employees, and I would argue that that is consistent with periods of time that people traditionally do not view as work, similar as a trial or a break-in period. And so that's how you can read that first sentence. If the legislature wanted to have it for any time, they could have said any time an employee works, you know, it could have been much more clearer. But by tying it to trials or break-in periods, it makes clear that that was not the intent of the legislature.
Sorry, so I'm just trying to press you a little bit. So sure. Let's assume for a moment she's not a union employee. She's a typical non-union employee working for an employer, and the employer just gives her a paycheck for 35 hours, even though she worked 40 hours. What's her remedy then?
Well, if there's a contract, a breach of contract, or a common law claim to bring that.
No contract, at-will employee.
There may be a minimum wage violation. I guess we would need some more information as to that, and they could go through that avenue as well.
Right. So under minimum wage, obviously assuming other requirements are met, that she'd have to at least be paid minimum wage for all the time she works.
Correct. And Ms. Jackson,
if she was an at-will employee, she still has a contract to be paid for the hours she works. I mean, that wouldn't take payment for like, if you agree to pay me $5 an hour to babysit your dog and I work 10 hours, I get $50. And I could sue you even though I'm at will.
Correct.
Yeah.
And what's also missing is Jackson William alleged to have worked in the complaint over at least 40 hours each week. So any additional time on top of what alleged off-the-clock work she did would actually be overtime, and that's covered under the CBA and clearly falls under 018's exception for collective bargaining agreements. So appellants are trying to do a backdoor because they can't go through the overtime exception through using 016 as an avenue, and that just leads to absurd results and a situation like this where the CBA clearly provides otherwise for overtime, yet they're arguing that 016 should compensate for that time.
Could I return you to the statutes of limitations? And you make an argument in your brief that even crediting the argument that Perry doesn't necessarily control the statutory ones under NRS 11 point whatever it is, 090, the penalty subparagraph, which is the same two-year period, should control over the other one, which is the three-year or the four-year ones that aren't provided otherwise. Could you address the penalty issue and secondarily the statute issue, because NRS 11.190 is a standard old form statute of limitations catch-all, and I wonder what other states have done that have confronted similar issues on implied liability and statutes as opposed to a statute that expressly creates liability.
Well, first as to the penalty provision, the final paycheck penalties clearly are a penalty to the employer that the employer has the opportunity to cure if they're put on notice of the penalty. So therefore, it clearly would fall into that section requiring 2 years. And that also goes to how can you have a claim for overtime that would be a longer statute of limitations period than the final paycheck period. It would just be completely inconsistent with Nevada's statutory scheme that the legislature has enacted requiring employers to keep wage records for 2 years. And that goes to another kind of problem with the cure period with appellant's argument, what they're asserting. The big problem with their argument is they're trying to stretch the implied right of action first found in Neville in 2017 to such an extreme that it would require this court to rewrite the final paycheck statutes. Inherent in those final paycheck statutes is an explicit cure provision that appellants keep characterizing as a 30-day period, but it's actually meant to put the employer on notice of the exact amount due to the employee so that the employer can cut off or cure any penalties by paying that amount before the expiration of the 30-day period. The phrase until paid or for 30 days, whichever is less, means the statute contains that provision. In other words, if the employer pays the final wages on day 10, that cuts off the penalty on that day. Unless there are any further questions, I would just respectfully request that you affirm the orders of the district court.
Colleagues, any questions? Okay, thank you. Okay, Mr. Buck, you got 2 minutes and 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honors. First, I'd like to address Justice Pickering's question with respect to the continuation wages and the statute of limitations, and the reference to the word penalty in the title of those particular statutes, so which statute, which limitations period should govern. In our brief, we make a distinction that even though it says penalty in the title, they're really wages under the statute. Frankly, Your Honor, you can read it either way. If the court is inclined to consider it a penalty, then under the Section 11, there is a penalty limitations period, and it would be a two-year limitations period under 6 NRS 11. But I want to emphasize this is a little bit of a legacy issue at the moment because the Nevada legislature has amended the continuation wage statutes and they took effect July 1st of 2021. In Senate Bill 245, the Nevada legislature specifically added a limitations period in the continuation wage statutes for a two-year limitations period. However, it has redefined the definition of wages to include continuation wages. So it's a little bit of an odd scenario where the Nevada legislature specifically set forth a statute of limitations under the continuation wages for 2 years, but defined the remedy or the 30 days of additional relief as being wages owed to employees. So for this court is dealing with the statute back in 2014, which was pre-amendment. But I still think it is helpful to look at the Nevada legislature's amendment here. And the question would be, well, doesn't that undercut your argument that, you know, the other claim should be a 3-year limitations period? And that, I would say no. The Nevada legislature, when it wants to put a specific limitations period within a specific statute, it is very capable of doing so. But when it is silent, we have to look to the general limitations provision that the Nevada legislature has provided for us.
Wouldn't it, though, Mr. Buck, kind of create a practical difficulty for folks if we adopt a 3-year statute of limitations when 608.115 says employers only keep wage records for 2 years?
Practically, it's a very good point. Practically, no, Your Honor. And the reason why is there are numerous different record-keeping requirements beyond the 2 years, if I may finish my thought.
Please. Is that okay?
Yes.
Thank you. I shouldn't have spoken.
For example, look through the federal wage and hour laws, the FLSA. The FLSA contains a 3-year limitations period for willful violations. But under the FLSA, there's only a 2-year requirement to maintain wage records. Same potential inconsistency. But really what it comes down to is it this court's responsibility to remedy potential inconsistency that has been created by the Nevada legislature? I would submit it's not. I would submit that there are inconsistencies that this court deals with maybe on more occasions than it would like from the Nevada legislature. But it's still the Nevada legislature's responsibility to make those changes.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
All right. Counsel, thank you for the briefs and the arguments today. This matter will stand submitted.